Good afternoon. So last time we went over sort of general course overview, kind of where this course hopefully fits in with things, mentioning we have our focus on malware and some logistical stuff. And we just kind of talked generally about categorizing malware. And we had kind of like two big things we looked at. So one is kind of traditional naming of malware often comes from the method by which it gets installed on systems. So we have kind of our most traditional names of viruses and worms, named because they were self-spreading malware, which used to be kind of the primary form of malware back in the early days. And we have these sort of more sort of human-involved systems with trojans and these potentially unwanted programs, which like get installed the same kind of way normal applications do. We don't have some sort of vulnerability or, you know, direct deception happening the way that is sort of the older malware used to. We also looked at motivations, and very often when we look at malicious software, there's kind of a direct criminal and monetary motivation. So we had things like adware, displaying ads, there's a way to get paid for that. Stealing credentials, there's a way to monetize those credentials. Taking over machines to rent them out for doing other malicious things like performing fraudulent clicking on ads or things like that. And we mentioned that the way that these sort of criminal operations typically work is that it's not kind of a vertically integrated thing. It's not the case that someone, you know, writes a piece of malware and directly, you know, does some credential stealing or adware and, you know, is doing that whole process. Typically, there's a lot of subcontracting and people are doing different parts. And very often, the person writing the malware is the person running it, for example. Because there are these black markets that exist for services, not just of like doing the malware, but of like if you get some banking credentials, like the criminal who gets them is typically not actually the one taking the money out of the bank account. They'll often have someone else do that because that's a specialized task that's high risk to do. And we mentioned that if you're thinking inside of a commercial or a policy context of how to combat malware, this is an important factor to think about because it might be easier to fix the problem of stealing credentials being very valuable than it is to sort of directly address it with malware. You probably want to do both, but you know, you can think of a whole wide spectrum. We also mentioned another big category of malware is kind of stuff that is personal, sort of things with harassment and stalking. And this kind of has a difference in how we expect the malware, you know, spread to happen that is important if we're thinking about malware detection, right? When we're thinking about this monetization malware, like we often kind of expect someone to, you know, spray across everywhere and they're fine with, you know, getting lucky a couple times, and they, you know, aren't likely to spend a lot of time carefully targeting their attack and spending a lot of effort on it because they're kind of looking for the quickest way to get something. Whereas in these harassment and stalking cases, typically it's going to be a lot trickier to think about what kinds of access and what kind of how tailored the attack is going to be. And therefore, what we would need to do to defend against that is going to be very different. And we mentioned espionage, which I cannot spell when I typed a couple hours ago. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so we're going to talk a bit about assembly because we're going to be doing a bunch of stuff with vulnerabilities and exploits where we really want to know about either analyzing malware Or, and what malware does to avoid being analyzed, and also know about exploiting programs that are buggy in memory exploit ways. So for both the task of analyzing malware and doing and exploiting programs, it's going to be really useful for us to kind of know a lot about, you know, how programs work at a machine code slash assembly level. I'm going to start by going over some things in assembly, and in this class, I'm going to mostly use 64-bit x86 assembly. For talking about viruses, because the heyday of viruses is like 40 years ago, we're not going to use x86 assembly to show you some real examples of major viruses, because they weren't written when 64-bit was a thing. But our assignments, I'm going to do in 64-bit x86 assembly, which means they run on Portal and no machine. And for doing your own work, if you have a 64-bit x86 machine, having a Linux environment on it would probably be helpful. If you have a 64-bit ARM machine, having a native Linux environment on it in a VM, a native ARM, because if you do x86, it'll be super slow, will probably be helpful, but our kind of my intention is that the assignment should be doable on Portal and no machine, though you might want to be able to do things locally. So 64-bit x86 assembly has this history that it's derived from 32-bit x86 assembly, and 32-bit x86 is in turn derived from 16-bit x86, which is in turn derived from an earlier 8-bit processor. And this comes up a whole bunch of times if you look at, want to explain why is the assembly so ugly, and it's going to really come up when we talk about the encoding of the machine code. And the history here is that in the late 90s, early 2000s, I shouldn't actually know the date, but I would need to look it up, but originally AMD constructed a 64-bit extension to x86. So AMD and Intel were, at the time, definitely the two biggest, and there was a few others, but, you know, the biggest manufacturers of x86-compatible chips. There were VIA, I think, was relatively big at the time, but they were biggest, and they wanted to go into the 64-bit space because we were starting to want to have more than 4 gigs of RAM, and they wanted to like target the server space. And you might say, why did AMD construct this? Because if you know the history of x86, it was Intel design instruction set. And at the time, Intel had this vision of segmenting the market. So they were working on something called Itanium. And their idea was that if you were doing server stuff, you would get an Itanium processor, and if you were doing that cheap PC stuff, you'd get one of Intel's x86 processors. Turns out Itanium was not very commercially successful, but this is what they were trying to do to address the same thing AMD was, when AMD just said, let's just make addresses bigger in this instruction set, and the registers larger at the time. And so eventually, when Intel realized Itanium wasn't doing so well, people didn't like a fully incompatible new architecture, they copied it and gave it their own name, which originally they used this name EM64T. And then they later used the marketing term Intel 64 to refer to their copy of AMD's extension to their instruction set. So that's the history, and I'm mentioning this partly because, you know, you might see things like IA64. That is this. It is not 64-bit x86, typically. And it also is responsible for weird naming you'll see when you look things up about these instruction sets, that you'll see sometimes some places will call this AMD 64, some places will call it x86 64. Some might label it, you know, something with Intel. And you also might think they label this Intel 64 that's from the Itanium era, meaning it's actually Itanium. And so. Now, the other reason I'm mentioning this is that Typically, when we've done assembly in prior classes, you probably used kind of references which were from textbooks or random things you found online. And for this class, I would like to make sure you know how to actually look the things up in the definitive sources. And both Intel and AMD publish processor manuals that are very comprehensive. So Intel has this manual. The Intel 64 and IA32, this is what Intel calls 32-bit x86. And because of the Itanium debacle, they don't call 64-bit x86 IA64, they call it Intel 64. And this is their manual, and AMD has a similar manual they publish. You can download this as a PDF online. It's free, you don't have to pay for it. They sell through print-on-demand hard copies. They don't make them themselves anymore, which is probably for the better. Currently, this is 25 megabytes and a bit over 5,000 pages. Obviously, you're not going to read that. But volume 2, which is roughly half of that 5,000 pages, is the instruction set reference. So if you see some assembly and you see some instruction you don't understand, you can figure out really what it is and get a definitive answer from it here. And I'll go through what this manual page looks like. This is a little hard to read. And also, this will be important when we talk about machine code because it's going to show us machine code. So here I have the manual page for the increment instruction, INC. We have the instruction in Intel syntax with a placeholder of R for a register and M for a memory value. And the SOT number, like 8, 32, 64, is the size of that value. We have the encoding. We'll talk more about what this encoding means next time or next week. So how to interpret that, but this tells you what the encoding is if you want to figure it out. But you have to we'll have to talk about what is, these things mean and this table later. And all the variants of the instruction. And there's also kind of a description of what the instruction does, including, our pseudocode for it. And also kind of comprehensive information about how it affects the flags and all those corner cases that you might wonder about. They should be documented. So I mention this not because I expect you to routinely things up, but if you see a weird instruction, there is a place to actually look it up. That most of the time should get you your answer. Yes, with a little work or sometimes a lot of work, because these manuals are not, are written to be read by particular people who are in the Intel lingo. But it's not going to be missing any instructions or anything like that. So we have our instruction encoding. We have the instruction for Intel assembly. Something to note is that this table indicates whether it works in 64-bit mode, which is typically what we'll be dealing with, and whether it works in other modes, the 16 or 32-bit mode. And we always have information about how the flags, the condition codes are affected, and also about all the possible exceptions, meaning hardware exceptions, things that run the OS that can happen. So in this case, for example, our first exception, there's a few more that are cut off from the screenshot, is that, we could try to write to non-writable memory with this instruction, or so you're going to get an exception that Intel calls GP. So that's on instruction manuals. Mainly mentioning this because I want people to have something that's better than Googling, CLTD and, finding five different descriptions of it and not sure means you can actually look up what the sort of definitive answer is. Questions on? I should stop at this slide. Nice. It's also going to mention some things about registers. So this is the chart from Wikipedia of all the general purpose registers, well, and some one not general purpose. This is our instruction pointer. Okay, PC. So we have our, in 64-bit x86, we have 16 general purpose registers plus the instruction pointer, which we can reference in assembly. And we can reference different parts of them with different names. So for example, for R13, we can reference the least significant byte of it as R13B, the least significant 2 bytes as R13W, the least significant 4 bytes as R13D, and the whole thing is R13. For these first few registers, we actually can reference the least significant byte and the second least significant byte as separate registers. And a lot of this is kind of quirks left over by this architecture being extended from 16 to 32 to 64 bit. So that's why all the most natural versions of the name, like ABC, are 16-bit versions, because that's where they were from. And on the 16-bit processor, they were really space constrained, so they liked having a way of naming the different parts of the registers they had at the time. And then they just added more and more registers. And also, we can kind of see that when we went from 32 to 64-bit, that's when the last 8 registers here were added, the register 9 through 15. And we have this, it represents the program counter, and specifically it represents the address after the currently executing instruction. Immediately after. So we have these overlapping registers, and you probably expect from this diagram that, you know, what would happen if I write to ECX, if I put like a 15 in here, that this won't change the rest of the register, the part that's not shared with RCX. And that's not quite how things work. And I mention this because compilers love using this. So if I write a value to RAX that uses all 64 bits, and then I clear EAX, which remember we have RAX is the whole register and this whole thing, and EAX is the least significant 32 bits. If I write to EAX and clear, just set EAX to 0, you kind of might reasonably expect, oh, that's going to mean that we're going to have the, you know, this top part here is still going to be in that top part. That is not how it works. When AMD extended the instruction set, they said that that would be bad for hardware efficiency and software efficiency. So, in fact, it clears the whole register, clears the upper bits of the register. So whenever you write to the 32-bit subregister, it clears the upper bits. And the compilers love using this because this instruction takes up less bytes to encode than the version with RCX instead. So compilers will do this all the time deliberately. And the same is true for this XOR EAX EAX. That takes up less bytes than XOR RAX RAX. So when you're looking at assembly actually generated in the real world, you'll see this happening all the time. And it's filled with zeros, so for example, this move 1 into the lower 32 bits doesn't change the upper. Sets the upper ones to zeros, so the whole RBX is not negative 1. It's some big, large value. Questions on what happens when I use the 32-bit subregisters? And a thing that makes this confusing is the smaller ones don't work this way. And that's because of our history that Intel made those extensions and there were different, it was a different time, there were different hardware priorities, so they That's not how those work. So another thing I need to talk about, AT&T syntax and Intel syntax. We will be seeing both this semester. So there's some tools we'll use that will usually show us AT&T syntax, some which will usually show us Intel syntax. So do both. So big things to notice as differences are, you know, the most obvious difference is that in AT&T syntax, our destination is first, or sorry, our destination is last. Sorry, I should circle consistently. So this is our destination of this instruction. And in Intel syntax, it is always first. That's probably the most noticeable difference and the thing you need to be careful to keep in mind. Another difference you'll notice here is that in AT&T syntax, we use this dollar sign to represent a constant. In Intel syntax, we just write the constant. If I don't use a dollar sign in AT&T syntax, that represents an address. If I wanted to do that in Intel syntax, so if I wanted to represent the address, you know, move from 0x1000 to RAX, that's move from a memory address to RAX in AT&T syntax. In Intel syntax, I do something with brackets for that and not with a percent sign. So that's the other notable difference. In AT&T syntax, we always have a percent sign before any register name. In Intel syntax, we don't do that. So you'll both, the Intel manuals obviously use Intel syntax. They wrote them and it's their syntax. This AT&T syntax, you might say, why is AT&T involved in any of this? It's from the Unix assemblers that, and Unix originated with AT&T, so that's where it comes from. So we have our syntax, destination last, constants with dollar, registers with percent. In AT&T syntax, they represent the operand length by sometimes appending a thing to the instruction. It is optional in some syntaxes, some cases. In this case, it's not optional because this instruction does a different thing if we're writing 8 bytes or 4 bytes or 2 bytes or 1 byte to that memory location. But if, for example, you know, instead I was moving RAX into that, well, that can only be a move queue, so you don't actually need to write the queue because RAX is 8 bytes. If I want to move less than 8 bytes, I should write EAX or CX or something, AX or similar. And our kind of general syntax for memory locations, we have this kind of four item form where we can actually omit things we don't want to use. So I can write 100, say, RCX4 if I don't want to specify a first register to add. And I can omit more things if I want from the syntax if they aren't relevant. And just the blanks are filled in with a sensible default of 0 or 1, depending on which one we're referring to. And this syntax, as we'll see when we talk about the machine code, kind of reflects the fields that are in the machine code. So the machine code, as we'll learn, has something kind of like a place to put the first number, a place to put an identifier for that first register, that second register, and that multiplier. So this kind of is the fields that exist in the machine code. And that's a reason I find the AT&T syntax more sensible. With Intel syntax, you just write out the expression. And if you write out an expression which doesn't fit in with the fields that are in the assembly, the assembler just tells you no. So you just have to know what options are possible. And also, our source destination works the same way. So this add, the subtract is a different thing than it would do, is a different order than it would be in Intel syntax. And it's still the same subtraction operation, which is kind of unfortunate. And Intel syntax, destination is first. Brackets represent a location in memory. We can explicitly say how big a location in memory is supposed to be if we need to, if it's not clear from context. And that's what we do instead of having a thing at the end of the instruction. So questions about our basic Intel versus AT&T syntax? Okay, so one other thing which will come up is LEA, which is the instruction I've had people have the most trouble reading, figuring, understanding when it appears in this assembly they're looking at, or compiler output they're looking at. It computes the address that we would access in memory and uses it. And the assembly syntax looks like a memory access, regardless of whether we're using, you know, Intel or AT&T syntax. So in Intel syntax, this would be LEA REX 4 plus REX. But it's not a memory access, it just does a computation. It does the computation of the address we would access and does it. And because it just does a computation and never accesses memory, you can use this to do math, and compilers do that all the time. And also, if you're writing assembly by hand, this is often the easiest way to do calculations. So very often you'll see this used when in fact the values are not addresses and they're just normal numbers, but we're using the address computation logic to compute some normal numbers. So for example, if I want to multiply REX by 5, I can use this instruction to do that. Or in Intel syntax, this would be LEA REX, comma X plus REX times 4. And that is probably the most efficient way to multiply by 5, so your compiler will generate it very often. And another confusing thing is that LEA has forms that produce a smaller than 64-bit number, even though pointers are 64-bit. So it just does the computation as 64-bit and truncates the top. Questions about these computations? Yeah?
Why is this faster as opposed to the dedicated instructions?
Why is this faster as opposed to the dedicated instructions? So our alternative for this here would be probably would be doing IMAL 5 RAX, I believe. And in the processor, there's a dedicated address computation unit. In fact, there's probably multiple of them. And there's also multipliers, but the multiplier is a generic multiplier. If, according to Intel's optimization manuals, like the address computation circuit is one, has a throughput of like one every, sorry, has a latency of one cycle, and the multiplier typically has three. The integer multiplier typically is three cycles because it does all integer multiplies. And it's not variable time. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so let's do a little assembly reading. So I have some assembly I have, and I have this string label that points to an ASCII string with a null terminator. That's what the .ASCII-Z does. And I have my assembly instructions, which I have hopefully correctly converted to Intel syntax. If you want to read the Intel syntax version instead. You can talk with your neighbor about what you're doing. Who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people.
Address of RAF.
Okay, let's do, I'm gonna go through this obviously. So let's do show of hands. So who thinks we have A? Is our correct answer? B? C? D? E? Okay, so I think the best answers are C or E, depending on your perspective. So what's going on here is this dollar string, or this syntax, we're using the label string, and labels are addresses effectively, so we're loading the address of the beginning of the string, the address of that A character, into RAX. And that's the only time we write into RAX itself, so we can just say that all the uses of RAX are using that address. And so in particular, this move B here, this is the first character of the string. So this here is first char string, and this here is the first char of the string again, and this here is four chars into the string. So we can kind of figure out where most of those memory accesses are going from that, knowing that RAX points to the beginning of the string, and everything else is like either at that beginning or four characters later. Then we have this move that treats the string as a 64-bit number and loads it into a register. So what that's going to do, it's going to take the first 8 bytes of the string, which is going to be the ASCII representation of the characters A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and treat it as an integer, you know, with the appropriate order. So because we're little endian, we're going to say have the least significant byte is going to be the A, and loads that into RDX. So RDX is this value as a long, and we're going to copy that value at the end to 4 bytes into the string. So something we're going to do is we're going to copy these first 8 characters and push them over here. And so that means that we're going to have A, B, C, D as our last, our 4 through 8 character, and G and E, F, G, H after that, And we don't know if there's an old terminator, so that's how I can get E. It's by saying, oh, we're putting stuff at, the string's getting bigger at a minimum. That's a way you could get E. If you think of the string as being fixed size, then we'll get C, and we'll see where the extra B comes from. And that's from this code here. So here, this is moves one byte into BL, and that byte is going to be the A, because that's where our pointer to the string is. Then we add 1 to it, treat that as an address. And why are we adding 1 to it? Well, because RBX is the full register, which BL is the bottom of. And I'm assuming, without evidence, that the rest of RBX was cleared in advance, but it probably was, and if it wasn't, it turns out I think we got the same number because we're only going to use the bottom 8 bits. So we add 1 to it and put that result back in RBX by putting it in EBX. And then we take BL, which is the bottom of EBX, bottom of RBX, and put it back at the beginning of the string. So 1 plus ASCII for A is the ASCII for B. So that's how we get the B being placed here. Questions? How to figure that out? Okay. Yes?
So when you move 1 plus the memory at RBX into EBX, you're just moving that one character B into the...
So you're talking about this?
Yes.
So that's not a move, that's a load effective address. That's a very important distinction. So we're computing 1 plus RBX, and we're not going to memory at all. We're just putting that in our EBX. So this is one of those cases where LEA is being used, even though it's called load effective address, it's just a math operation. It's not actually computing it's not actually accessing memory in any way. The term effective address, if it helps you remember it, is the address an assembly instruction would compute. So that's where that name comes from. So like in this move instruction here, the address computed by adding 4 to REX is its effective address. And that's why the instruction is called LEA. The load is kind of deceptive. Might as well call it move effective address. But that's what they used. Other questions? Or that answer your question? Okay. So, also some notes about reading. So often we want to turn binaries into assembly. We'll look at some other ways of doing this later. Probably the simplest way, which I think most of you have seen, is object jump. And it will show you the assembly. It's gonna mark symbols, which are, I will talk a little more about later, but named, you know, labels that appear in whatever executable or object file you're looking at. It's going to show you the address of the value. If the executable has a fixed address, it will be the address it will have in memory. If the executable doesn't have a fixed address, it won't be, but it will be relative in the file. It will show you the machine code of the parts in assembly. It will show addresses in hexadecimal, but they won't be labeled as hexadecimal. And it will show you the corresponding symbol for that. In some cases, there will be an address computation in the instruction that object dump can figure out. So for example, RIP is an offset from the current instruction. It's figured out that that is gonna be address 2004 in hex, which is 4 bytes after the label IO standard in used. So object dump does some of these address computations for you, and you want to make sure you know how to. Okay, so a couple other things with assembly to talk about. So one is I talked about definitive references for assembly syntax. I'd like to also talk about that for the calling convention. So you hopefully remember a calling convention from somewhere. I'm going to have a summary slide to remind you. But we're going to mostly be concerned about x86-64 Linux. This document has the actual official source on the calling convention. If you want to know about corner cases, like what happens when I pass a struct not as a pointer to a C function, this will tell you. This document, which I will have linked on the schedule and you can find, tell you. So it has a section on the function calling sequence, which goes through, talks about all the details, like also like, is this weird register caller or callee safe? It will tell you. The summary of the calling convention, as a reminder, on 64x86 on Linux, this is going to be different on different OSs, is that our first six arguments are passed in RDI, RSI, RDX, RCX, R8, R9, in that order. If there's floating point arguments, those aren't floating point registers, so actually XMM0, XMM1, etc. are used. Additional arguments are pushed on the stack if there are more than six arguments. And the return address is pushed on the stack because that's how the call instruction works, and that's pushed after any additional arguments because it's hard to call otherwise. And the return value is conventionally in RAX. So this gives us a typical calling sequence where if I want to call this function with a whole bunch of arguments, I'm going to push the additional arguments that don't fit in registers, copy everything else to registers, and call, run a call instruction. And this will give us a stack where we have a return address, the additional arguments, anything that the function calling it was using, and then after that, below that will be our stuff, whatever the function does that we call. Questions on my very brief calling convention review? Yeah, and as I mentioned, this document like handles all the corner cases that you might have questions about. If there is an answer, because compiler writers need to get it consistent, so that's why there's this document they have to reference, and that's what they should be following. Okay, and I was hoping I'd get through all these floating assembly nits, but I guess not. So, floating point operations. So x86 has two ways of doing floating point. You occasionally see floating point code. And there's this legacy way, which is the x87 floating point instruction. So the 3087 or 4087 was a floating point coprocessor. So it was a separate processor just for doing floating point, and that's where these instructions come from. And the x87 instructions have separate registers which form a stack, which are named ST parentheses and an index. This is my entire coverage of that because it rarely comes up, but occasionally you might see ST0 and wonder what that is. It's related to these floating point, this old floating point, which treats the registers as a stack, meaning the instructions kind of push onto the stack and it shift all the other registers. More commonly, you'll see floating point stuff done with the vector registers, the XMM registers, and these were designed to actually hold a bunch of floating point numbers, so we can hold actually four floats or two doubles in them, and they're these operations that will do a whole bunch of parallel adds or multiplies on some sets of these registers. So we have this move packed, add packed signal precision float. And that's how that works. But even though like they're intended to hold multiple values, this is also what you'll see done for code that only does a single value at a time. So here, this moves 32 bits into the 128-bit register, sort of just zeroing out the upper three quarters of the register. And this is multiply one set of values. So even though the register can hold 96 bits more values, this only deals with the bottom 32 bits. And if you write code that uses floats in C and compile it, you'll probably get code like this, which will use these 128-bit registers, even though it's a 32-bit value. Or if you use doubles, it will use the 128-bit registers for a 64-bit value and use these SS, or for double SD instructions, to manipulate them. Okay, so I guess I'm out of time, so I need to more. So next time we'll talk about a few more assembly nets and then go into how executables look on the machine and how they're loaded, and then start talking about machine code.